ABC Listen. Podcasts, radio, news, music, and more.
You're listening to The Country Hour on ABC Radio South Australia and Broken Hill.
Hi, Selena Green with you for the last Country Hour for this week. A shorter week for us. Have you ever heard the term inattentional blindness? Apparently it's something we all do to a degree, but it's something that could get you seriously injured or even killed on the farm. So stick around to find about that in a moment. More on that. And there's a growing market demand for the mineral kaolin. That could be good news for mining here in South Australia.
Our initial view of the project was 55,000 tonnes. We're looking at doubling the initial size due to market demand, and we're in the process of closing that out, right? Is it going to be 55, 75, 100,000 tonnes? We need to wrap that up to make sure that we can get to the final decision.
An update on that project coming at you shortly. If you want to get in touch with me throughout the program, my talkback number is 1300 222 891 or the text line 0467 922 891. But yes, that term inattentional blindness, have you ever heard of it? It's where an object is so common, so everyday, that we've become used to it and we gradually stop noticing it at all. And it's this inattentional blindness that SA Power Networks is targeting with a new safety campaign. It's aimed at farmers and reducing the number of incidents of farm machinery coming into contact with power lines. I spoke with the head of SA Power Networks Corporate Affairs, Paul Roberts. Asked him how often this happens.
It's very common. We get more than 20 incidents a year on farms where a vehicle of some sort generally strikes a power line. It could be a tractor or a harvester or some other machinery running over straight over the top of the stovey pole. It could be people putting sprinkler gear or raising an auger under a line. There's a number of different ways in which it happens, and of course every one of those incidents could potentially be fatal given the kind of energy that's travelling down the power lines across farms.
Yeah, I guess best case scenario is you're going to knock the power out for a bit until some repairs are done. Worst case scenario is you could lose your life and very quickly.
Yeah, look, very serious injuries, and even, you know, with an electric shock, most of the power lines across farms are generally at 19,000 volts. So the single wire earth return lines, as we call them, they're one single wire tightly strung across between poles across paddocks, and they're carrying 19,000 volts. That's a very significant amount of energy. It will cause, and with an electric shock, that will cause some terrible injuries, and you know, it could potentially also cause a death. We're very lucky in South Australia. We haven't actually had a death on a farm since about 2009 from memory. But we have so many incidents, 20 incidents where we recorded, plus countless near misses. And we think it's an issue that we need to keep reminding the community about, because there's a psychological thing as humans. When we keep seeing something, we tend eventually to shut it out. So it's called inattentional blindness. So we all know it. In the city or country, you drive past a sign every day and you stop seeing it after a while. We're thinking it's the same thing with stovey poles. Plus, there's also the distraction now with GPS. People are looking at mobile phones, making calls or whatever, and they're not fully attentive to the job they're doing, and they can run over the top of a stovey pole.
Right, so that's what this campaign will be focusing on, that particularly that inattentional blindness. So farmers who might be going out into the same paddock or same fields day after day, year after year, as you say, it's not a criticism necessarily of farmers,
but it is
something that we all do, where it's just something that is so common that we start to sort of lose attention to it.
Absolutely. We're not blaming farmers here. It's kind of recognising how we are as humans. That's how we actually cope with the vast amount of information that confronts us every day. What we want to remind farmers to do is every time they go out to do work, they need to assess what are the risks in that area that they're going to say for cropping or sowing as they're doing at the moment. Power lines are one of them. We have a website, a national website now called lookupandlive.com, where people can go on to that site and with some satellite mapping go right down and actually identify the location of power lines on their property to remind themselves. They can use that to help with entering into their GPS systems on farm to have that location. They can talk to others who are going out to work, because it's not always the farmer who's doing it. It might be a contractor, it might be a family member. So it's important to have that conversation about what are the risks on the job on that day. It's also, you know, people assume the power line is the same. It may not be. We may have done some work on it, or it may be an extremely hot day and the lines may be lower than normal because they do sag in heat. So this is something that people need to identify and to do something about. The other part of our campaign is also about vehicles such as tipper trucks. We have a number of incidents where people will park a tipper truck or even, for example, a spray boom under a power line and raise it. And they haven't noticed the power line, they haven't identified the power line, and they make contact with the power line, and that can cause very serious injury, obviously, as well. And it is a issue that we also want to raise during this campaign.
So the campaign itself, people will start to see some of this messaging in various media?
Yes, it'll be across press, radio and television. Obviously also in our digital world as well, where, you know, increasingly we try to reach people in their homes and on their mobile devices. But it's a very strong advertising campaign, and people will see kind of one aspect of it on television where the Stobie pole seems to appear and disappear, which is kind of gets to this point about not really seeing it and then seeing it perhaps too late.
And Paul, are there specific regions that you are focusing this on as we head into sowing season?
Yeah, absolutely. So broadacre farming area. So really starting now, the west coast of the Eyre Peninsula, people will be starting to do seeding. Some of them will be doing dry seeding. Some will be getting out and sowing. That will move across the state. So we'll see people starting to do that on York Peninsula in the mid-north and down towards the south. So we'll shift a little bit in our focus, but essentially all the broadacre cropping areas for this particular message around understanding and identifying where power lines are before you start sowing your crop.
That was Paul Roberts. He is the Corporate Affairs Manager with SA Power Networks. And that website is lookupandlive.com.au. Highly recommend it.
Saturday Night Country.
You performed on stage in Labor.
Yes, my husband was looking at me, who's my guitarist, and kind of giving me the look of, shall we cut this gig short? I'm like, no, I can get through it. It's fine.
I didn't even tell anyone I could sing when I was a kid because I didn't want to get beaten up at school.
You just do what you can one day at a time, and you try and put one foot in front of the other, not overwhelm yourself with too much. But, yeah, those ghosts are always there.
Saturday Night Country. We're online and on ABC Radio.
A heads up to wine producers, there may be some announcement coming out today around the Chinese tariffs. We understand the Prime Minister is visiting a vineyard in the New South Wales Hunter Valley this afternoon. The ABC understands he is expected to make some announcement about the Chinese tariffs being removed, but we'll have to wait and see on that. If that happens while the Country Hour is going to air, I'll let you know. But waiting, could today be the day? It's 13 minutes past 12. Well, earlier this month, the Victorian government announced they would be banning wild dog control on private and public land in the northwest of that state. The decision was largely based on a scientific paper by Dr. Kylie Cairns, which suggested most wild dogs are in fact dingoes and need to be protected. We heard from Dr. Cairns on the program last week. So could there be any changes on the way for South Australia? Well, Minister for Primary Industries Claire Scriven says any changes made to the state's plan for dingoes and wild dogs would need to consider a wide variety of evidence.
Yes, so it's about the balance between wild dogs and our livestock industries. It's about recognising, as we do, that wild dogs and dingoes are an important part of our landscape, but at the same time recognising that when the balance gets out of kilter, that can be devastating, both for the livestock industry but also environmentally. I mean, we've invested a large amount of money in rebuilding the dog fence, and that's, you know, a good way towards completion. And that has allowed a lot of re-emergence of various native animals and wildlife. So that's a real positive that you get from not having an overabundance of wild dogs or dingoes. Now, my understanding is the work by Dr. Cairns is still subject to peer review. My understanding or advice is that hasn't occurred as yet. I think that's really important. And that will feed into the overall body of evidence. But to it needs to be looked at that holistic way with all the other evidence that is available in terms of this particular issue.
Are there other management tactics that you look at other than baiting or eradication?
So it's a matter of management rather than, you know, overall eradication. As I mentioned, they are considered an important part of the landscape, but it's got to be utilising the various mechanisms that are available. And the dog fence, of course, is a big part of that. The real concern around the decision that's been taken in northwest Victoria is the significant impact it can have on South Australia. So that's what we're working through at the moment. We'll reach out again to the Victorian government. But it's also worth mentioning that I understand that the Victorian decision does allow for some exemptions. So we probably need some more detail around that as well. But certainly it is a concern. It's a large concern. And I'll be working with agencies and Dog Fence Board and others here in South Australia to see what we can do to protect our very important livestock industry.
You touched this a bit, but how do you get that balance of protecting local ecosystems and helping protect farmers as well?
Well, we consider that until this time we had the balance fairly right in South Australia. You know, one side of the dog fence is the attempt to eradicate, the other side is for the wild dogs to be free. So it's a matter of trying to maintain that balance. And we've, of course, worked in the past on the basis of the Victorian position. That has now changed, and so we have to reassess what options we have.
That is the Minister for Primary Industries, Claire Scriven, and she was speaking there to Brooke Neindorf. It's 16 minutes past 12.
You're listening to Selena Green on ABC Radio South Australia and Broken Hill.
Well, the South Australian mining company Andromeda Metals is looking to double the size of its major planned project at Putura near Streaky Bay, based on a growing market demand for the mineral kaolin. The company announced on Monday that it has completed the purchase of land for its Great White project, which was given approval by the state government back in 2020. It will mine for halloysite kaolin, which is used to produce products like porcelain. CEO Bob Cacheleros says they'll look at getting started fairly soon with the project expansion.
So, Brooke, we've just announced that we finalised our land purchase agreement, which is a big step. So that's paramount to making sure that, you know, our commitment to the community and to the shareholders is there. So that's a big step for us. We believe owning the land is a key part of the project, right? The land that we're mining on and the land we're ultimately responsible for remediating. It's a 28-year mine life. So that agreement is done with the local landholders, and we're very, very happy to be proud owners of the land we're going to mine. So that's a key step.
Was that always going to be how it was going to work, that you would purchase the land, or was it started off as a bit of a lease agreement?
Yes. We started off with an intent to purchase. We had the agreement in place, and then as we finalized the PEPA and the mining lease, it became clear exactly the land that we would purchase, the acreage, the sort of layout, and so that led to a final agreement with the landholders on the purchase for the Great White, which is probably the 28 years of mine life, is going to be on land that we own, which is a very, very good step for us.
What does this mean now with the process of where the mine is at?
Yeah, so where we are now, Brooke, is we're clearly, you know, looking at demand. We're clearly looking at sizing the project. Our initial view of the project was 55,000 tons. We're looking at doubling the initial size due to market demand. And we're in the process of closing that out, right? Is it going to be 55, 75, 100,000 tons? The associated offtakes and the revenue line that ties into demand, we need to wrap that up to make sure that we can get to the final FID decision. So that's where we are. We've decided to look at a larger project, right? Simply because the demand for the product is there. We want to make sure we have the offtakes in place for that larger project. When we have that size and offtakes in place, you know, we'll be ready at that time to go to final FID. And that's where we're at. We're at that point where we can say, look, this is the size, these are the offtakes, and now we just need to get funded and going. We're still looking aspirationally for first shipments in March, April next year.
So when it comes to funding, you said they're looking at you needing to get funded. What sort of funding is now needed to move forward?
So we'll need a portion of debt funding and equity funding, right? So we're trying to wrap up the final, you know, exactly what that looks like for the debt side of our business and for our shareholders, existing shareholders and new shareholders on the equity side. So there's clearly a capital intensity, right? Going to a bigger volume makes more sense in terms of the capital required for almost double the volume. So we're looking through that, and we'll announce those details when we have them in terms of capital, volume, binding offtakes, and the rationale of why a bigger project makes sense for all shareholders involved.
Now that the project is bigger than first anticipated, what does that mean for the workforce? Are you needing double the workers to come in as well?
We'll need more workers, Brooke. We'll need also the staging of the project, right? All the long lead time items are on order, right? So, there are probably additional steel, there's additional contractors needed in that initial stage. But I think in terms of the impact to the local community, I think it's positive in terms of getting the project up and built and the size of the project and the people needed to run the plant. So that final engineering has been done. We're looking through the capital efficiency of that and making sure that makes sense in terms of the size, right? The size and the associated funding that's required for that. But I would say at this point in time, I'd say it looks very good and very appealing.
Bob, we've spoken about this before with Andromeda Metals and workers coming in and the issue of not a lot of rental places or places to live in that area. Is that something that the company is still looking at of where to put these workers?
Yeah, we're looking at that. We're working with partners in Poochera. We're working with the Kent Town Council and the mayor in Streaky Bay. There's housing that's important, Brooke, but there's also services, right? Childcare, schooling, hospitals, right? All of that. We need to be across all of that. Affordable housing also is important, and I think the communities are very supportive. Both on a temporary basis and more of a full-time basis, there are plans in place to make sure that housing, over a period of time, is available. And look, it's good for the community and it's good for us. I think one of the biggest challenges was water. So we've come to an agreement with SA Water on water for the mine, and we want to make sure that water agreement ultimately translates to something positive for both our partners in Poochera and Streaky Bay, where water's an issue all the time, right? Be it for landholders or for the local communities. So we want to make sure that ultimately the agreements we get in place means that we address that issue for everyone, including roads as well, right, which are a big issue.
How would the agreement with SA Water work for the water that's needed for the mine?
Yeah, so it took us a better part of a year to negotiate that, and they'll be partners. SA Water will be partners in a portion of that line, and the remaining part of that line down to the mine, we will build it as in part of the initial capital. That means that we will not be tapping any of the water that the current landholders are using, and so that's a really, really big plus in terms of that availability. Further to that, there'll be options to do more with that as the mine expands, but that's a big step in the right direction.
Talking about the market and how that has expanded, is it still China that are the main purchaser or main buyers in this situation, and is it still that sort of porcelain that they're looking at using it for?
Yeah, Brooke, it's interesting. Since the last time we talked, we have pivoted and seen a much bigger demand for our product in Europe, right? And you say it's like a long way, right? But we see the European large format porcelain tile makers, the people that make the big tiles, super thin, super high-end, they see our product as a product that they can blend in with all the other requirements that they have. Of course, the fact that all those minerals from Ukraine don't and are not available to the Europeans anymore gives us the ability to compete in that market. Now, it's interesting to note that we just signed, you'll see that ASX announcement a while back, maybe about a month ago, a binding offtake with Ibero Clays, which is in Spain. They're the largest formulator of industrial minerals for high-end tiles across Europe. So we have a 5-year binding offtake for our product, 15 to 20,000 tons with them. Very, very big step for us in that market. Having said that, China, Japan, Southeast Asia will still be a market. But I think what's also evolved, Brooke, is India, right? India is catching up quickly in technology, especially in terms of porcelain tableware, porcelain tiles, porcelain countertops. And that is a market that we are keen to get into, and certainly will be part of our plans in the near and medium term.
As Andromeda Metals CEO, Bob Cacheleros, there speaking with Brooke Neindorf. Text that's come in about this one, a name, but it says this person believes the mine should not happen until a desal plant for water is built, as the Lincoln Basin will not sustain drawdown on water. And a text about power lines and the SA Power Network's campaign to get us to look up and live. Steve, on his text, says it'd be great to have large reflective plates around stoby poles. Can be very hard to see at night and in dusty conditions. It's 25 past 12, off to the Weather Bureau. Simon Timke, hello, happy Thursday.
G'day, Selena, thank you very much, and the same to you.
Well, fill us in, what's happening with the weather?
Well, look, a pretty quiet day weather-wise over South Australia today. The synoptic chart shows a high-pressure system centred sort of south of Kangaroo Island, west of Tassie, giving us pretty stable conditions, mostly clear skies as well. We did have a little bit of patchy fog and low cloud about the lower southeast, the eastern slopes of Mount Lofty Ranges, Kangaroo Island, and the southeastern part of Eyre and York Peninsulas. Also a bit of low cloud out over the Nullarbor Plain, but that's largely cleared away, although a bit of cloud still persisting about the lower southeastern KI. A little bit of patchy high cloud over the north of the state, but generally speaking, mostly sunny conditions right across the state today. Not expecting any showers or rain. That will change a little bit over the next couple of days, though, as that high moves out over the Tasman during Friday. We'll see our winds turn around a little bit more northeasterly. We'll see the temperatures rise a little bit over the next couple of days. And as that happens, a broad trough moves over the north of the state, bringing some more unstable conditions and some showers and thunderstorms. On Friday, I think they're most likely in the far northwest and far northeast. And most likely during the afternoon and evening. And there is potential for some local heavy rainfall with some severe thunderstorms right up in the very far northeast corner, northeast of about Moomba. On Saturday, that trough moves a little bit westwards, and we see a bit of a southward movement of some of that weather. So on Saturday, we're looking at showers and isolated thunderstorms across the pastoral districts, probably adjacent parts of the Flinders and possibly Riverland districts as well. And again, chance of some local heavy falls with severe thunderstorms over the northeast pastoral district, northeast of about Lee Creek. On Sunday, that weather starts to contract eastwards a little bit. So showers and isolated thunderstorms about the northeast pastoral district and again, adjacent parts of the northwest pastoral district, Flinders district, and Riverland district might pick up a little bit as well, but mostly the northeast pastoral district. And a chance of some, again, some local heavy falls near the eastern border of the northeast pastoral district. Further south, mostly dry conditions across that Friday, Saturday, Sunday period. Maybe a little bit of patchy morning fog about some parts, but should be mostly dry. Monday, Tuesday, Wednesday, a little bit different though. There's a front pushing up from the southwest, which will bring a little bit of shower activity. So on Monday and Tuesday, some showers about central and eastern districts, maybe the odd rumble of thunder about eastern districts as well, but contracting eastwards and southwards through the middle part of next week. So the weather sort of easing a bit through the middle part of next week. But certainly some potential for some reasonable rainfall up over the pastoral districts. And for that four-day period out to the end of Monday, generally less than 2 millimetres near southern coast, so mostly dry in the south. But the falls across the north will be a little bit variable with the convective nature of the weather. But we are likely to see some falls of up to around 20 millimetres across the pastoral Flinders district, possibly the northern parts of the Riverland there as well. And with some thunderstorms, local higher falls are possible, 20 to 60 millimetres possible with thunderstorms over the parts of the pastoral districts, particularly the northeast pastoral district. And the odd spot might even pick up a little bit more if we get a slow-moving thunderstorm. So bit of weather around the north in particular over the Easter long weekend, Selena.
All right. Thanks for that, Simon. You have a great Easter.
Thanks, Selena. Hope you do too.
Simon Timke there from the Weather Bureau. Now for the upper western parts of western inland New South Wales tomorrow, mostly sunny, slight chance of a shower in the northwest in the afternoon and evening, near zero chance of rain elsewhere. There is a chance of a thunderstorm in the northwest in the afternoon and evening. Overnight, between 16 and 21, daytime temperatures in the low to mid 30s. For the lower western district, sunny. Overnight, between 9 and 15 degrees in the low to mid 30s during the day. It's 12:30 here on the Country Hour.
You're listening to The Country Hour. For more stories from across the country, go to abc.net.au/rural. On ABC Radio Adelaide, South Australia and Broken Hill, this is Selena Green. Selena Green.
Hi there. Well, many of you would be about to roll into a long weekend break. What are your plans if you are one of the lucky ones who's getting a bit of an extended Easter break? Do they involve throwing in a line? Maybe you're keen to catch some abalone. Well, there have been some changes to fishing rules along a popular part of our coast just in time for the Easter long weekend, and I'll get you up to speed on that in just a sec. And a lot of farms across Australia rely on workers from the Pacific Island, and some who've been working in the state's Riverland are heading home with some new kits donated by one of the local soccer clubs.
Palm is a big program. It's making a big contribution economically to the nation. But this is a component of Palm that we are seeing a lot of engagement in, which is the social element. You know, the church is a big one, and sport. These are two elements where the workers from the Pacific are actually contributing because this is part of their life.
It's a great story coming up, so hang around for that. It's all coming after headlines with Matt Coleman. Hello.
Hello, Selena. In the news this afternoon, the Premier says gaining another Member of Parliament from the Dunstan by-election does not change how he will approach key issues like health. The Liberal Party conceded yesterday. Labor's Cressida O'Hanlon will replace former Premier Stephen Marshall as the MP for the inner eastern suburbs seat. The ABC understands the cash transport company Armaguard has been given until the end of today to either accept or reject a financial lifeline to avert insolvency and to keep cash flowing to major businesses. Major banks, supermarkets, Australia Post and the retailer Wesfarmers proposed a $26 million rescue package last week, but the consortium has yet to receive an answer from Armaguard. And the federal government will spend $1 billion to encourage solar panel manufacturing in Australia, including creating a manufacturing hub in the New South Wales Hunter Valley. One in three Australian households have solar panels, which is the highest rate in the world, but only 1% of them are manufactured locally. More news at 1 o'clock.
Thanks, Matt. Matt Coleman with those headlines. Well, yeah, just in time for the Easter long weekend, fishing restrictions have eased along a section of the southeast coastline where a lethal abalone virus has been detected. Well, from today, the response is now transitioning to what's being called management as opposed to containment. Well, PIRSA says eradication of the abalone viral ganglioneuritis is not feasible, but rules remain in place to try and stop it spreading to other parts of South Australia's coastline. The outgoing incident controller for PIRSA's response for AVG, Professor Peter Appleford, explains what the ease restrictions in the southeast mean.
Because it's endemic in that area, people can go and fish. So it moves into a management zone, which is east of the River Murray mouth. And if you're fishing in waters less than 30 metres, we're just asking you to do three things, which is clean your equipment when you're there on the site. So get all the external material off it. And when you get out of the water, wash it with detergent or a disinfectant and then dry it before you go back into the water again. It's the aim to, that should stop the disease surviving if it is on any of your equipment and stop you moving it to another part of the zone or part of the state. If you want to move from east of the River Murray mouth to west of the Murray River mouth, then we're asking you to actually dry it for 3 days so it's absolutely completely dry before you put it back in the water so we don't move it to other parts of the state.
So if you're staying within the southern zone and doing fishing activity that doesn't concern abalone, it's completely unrestricted. You can do whatever you want as long as you clean things.
Yes, that's right. We're just encouraging people to use good biosecurity practices. So they're not mandated, but we're asking you to clean, wash and dry. They're the three key words we want people to keep in mind. So clean your equipment where you are before you leave the site where you're fishing. Wash your stuff on shore with detergent or some sort of disinfectant and dry it before you go back in the water again. If you are an abalone fisher, there's a closure in between surface waves and Point of Kuru out to about 7 kilometres or 3.5 nautical miles, just because that's where the disease is. We need to let the disease run its course and just then do the stock assessment to see what stock's there before we open it back up to fishing again.
Where is there an abalone fishing closure still?
There's an abalone fishing closure in between Surface Way and Point of Kuru and it goes out about 7 kilometres or 3.5 nautical miles out into the ocean, so they can't go and fish for abalone in that area.
What happens if you do want to move out of the southern zone?
If you want to move out of the southern zone, then it's the same rules apply that we're encouraging people to use within the zone, which is wash your equipment within the zone to remove all the external material. When you land, wash it with detergent or disinfectant, but then you need to dry your equipment for 3 days. So if you're moving from within the zone to outside of the zone, then the additional thing is to dry it for 3 days, and that will ensure that the virus is deactivated and we won't move it between zones.
Mm. And Professor, now that we're moving to this, you know, management way of existing with AVG, what does that mean? Are we expected to see it spread further, or is this kind of the extent of it now?
It's a bit hard to tell. It's hard to tell whether it's been there the whole time and just expresses itself occasionally in little pockets, or whether it's been introduced and going to move. But the abalone divers are out there very regularly, both the recreational and commercials, and we're asking them to keep an eye out for it. The key sign is weakness of the abalone. They won't attach to the rock very hard, or they'll have fallen off or dead and die in abalone. Then we can have a look and see whether it's moved to a different spot, and if it has, then we would probably look at putting a fisheries closure around there again until the disease has run its course.
So this isn't, you know, the end of PRRSA and fisheries being active in the area?
It's the end of all the controls under the Livestock Act, so we won't be closing any more fishing down, as in generally to rock lobster and other fishes. There'll just be closures put in place around where the disease is if it shows up again, just for sustainability reasons, because it does impact the abalone stocks, and we don't want fishes going in after it's been there and then taking any remaining abalone and having an ongoing impact on the sustainability of the stocks.
Professor Peter Appleford from PRRSA, they're speaking to Beck Chave. So highly recommend, if you want to get across all the information, including the guidelines for decontamination, and see a map of the abalone closure area so know exactly what you can and can't do and where, it's all on the PRRSA website, pir.sa.gov.au/AVG. And if you do see any sick or dead abalone anywhere in South Australia, call the Fish Watch hotline on 1800 065 522 or use the SA Fishing app to report it. It is 23 minutes to one. Well, as we heard yesterday, a community consultation took place in Wilcannia in far west New South Wales to discuss the town's weir project. The proposed project to rebuild Wilcannia's weir has been changed by the state government, and residents there say they've been lied to. They say they feel hijacked by the lack of consultation. Bukkinji man and chair of the Wilcannia Aboriginal Land Council, Michael Kennedy, was at the meeting. He says the weir needs to be done right to ensure it's future-proof and meets the needs of the entire community.
It's definitely taken a lot longer than everybody expected, which is pretty disappointing. But I think we've still got a long way to go, and hopefully we can get a weir built here. Want to make sure that it's done right, because we know that once this weir is done, that's it. You know, that's what we got for the rest of our lives and our future generations' lives, you know. So everybody, you know, whether you're black, white, station owner, doesn't matter. Like, we're not looking at it as a black-white issue. This is something that everybody has come together to fight, and we just want to make sure that we get it right. You know, we just want a better weir design than what they've come up with. We really feel like they're trying to just pull the wool over our eyes and just slap a weir in and be done with it and don't got to worry about Wilcannia again, you know. So it's disappointing to us, because the design that they've come up with, we can see all the flaws in that. We know that that's not going to be good enough to do what it needs to do. The consultancy now is just, we're going over the same issues, same problems. So, you know, our next step moving forward from here is we want to see the decision makers out here, you know, the ministers and the people that sit at the top that can make the decisions and listen to us and make the changes that we need to make to get this done. This project team obviously has a boss that they got a report to that reports to the minister, you know, so ultimately at the end of the day, the ministers and that are the ones that sign off on these projects and make the decisions around these projects. So they need to be the ones that come out here and listen to the people and try and work together with the people to make this happen.
Akinji man and chair of the Wilcannia Aboriginal Land Council, Michael Kennedy there. Well, the project manager for the Wilcannia Weir Replacement Project from the Department of Climate Change, Energy, Environment and Water, Sarah Horn, she spoke with Oliver Brown after she presented the current project plan to the community yesterday. As she says, the environmental impact statement process played a large role in the change of design to the Weir project, but she will pass on the feedback and concerns from the community.
So the proposed design, which was exhibited in the EIS, that is the way we go through all planning approvals. We propose something, we then have to listen to all of the feedback that comes in. So when the EIS was exhibited, we had submissions not just from individuals and stakeholder groups, but also from government agencies, talking around the operational requirements for it, all of the safety factors, all of the environmental impact factors. There's a lot that goes into making sure we achieve the right balance for a project to minimise that overall environmental impact but deliver the outcomes. It's the environment, it's the social, it's the cultural, it's the economic, it's all of those factors. So there was some real key feedback what we received to the EIS submissions, and really the focus is around the long-term safety and operational of the previous proposed design, the environmental impacts of it, and particularly the downstream impacts for flows that proposed option was going to have. All of that led us to revising the design to still achieve that really key outcome. Our focus objective for Wilcannia is improving that town water security, providing a fish passage to improve outcomes for native fish, and also the cultural connection for Barkindji people to the water. We know how vital having a weir pool in Wilcannia is for the happiness in general of the community. So deliver those objectives, but balance all of that feedback what we received. So all of that has led us to the revised design, but we very clearly hear that the community are not happy with that revised design and would prefer to see the original design, despite all of those other factors we've talked about.
It seems, at least from the community's perspective, that they've made it very clear from the get-go since you started pushing this new design, or at least presenting it to them, that they are not happy with it whatsoever. So can you please explain for us why it's taken this extended period, why you keep coming back again and again to just receive the same response, I suppose?
So there are set processes which we must follow for an EIS. We have to be able to demonstrate that we have brought all of the information out to community and not just publish an amendment report and say, here, go and read 2,000 pages. That is the importance of continuing to come out and out again. I completely understand the community's frustration with that and that there is serious stakeholder fatigue in the community around this. There are also significant other broader issues at play, genuine concerns that the community has, but they are things which the project itself doesn't have control or the ability to generate change in those. Those concerns we do really clearly hear and we sympathise with, and we absolutely take those back to our department and we pass those through the channels back to our minister. But what we are trying to do is get on with the job, to get planning approval in place, get in and get a weir built, which will deliver for Wilcannia. It will be future-proofed so that if there are those changes to broader policy pieces in the future, it could be raised or it could have gates. There will be that ability. But what we are presenting here is something that we can get on, get planning approval for, and get built, because we have spent long enough doing all of the development and planning. We want to get on with the doing so we can secure that improvement in water security Wilcannia so vitally needs.
At the very beginning of your presentation, you spoke about an ideal timeline that the project team would like to work towards.
So what we are hoping is to have the EIS amendment report, including all of this vital community feedback, completed by the middle of the year and submitted to the planning department for their final determination. We hope to have their determination by the end of the year, and we hope to be able to start main construction works early next year and get in and get it built. all of the feedback that we've heard today means we go back, we continue to have those discussions with all of those who have raised concerns. So that includes our colleagues in other agencies like Fisheries and Water New South Wales, Biodiversity Conservation, all of the elements that plug into it. We continue to have those conversations and see if there are any further refinements. But we continue to want to push through to get a planning approval and get on and get it built. Enough time has been spent in the development phase. We want something that delivers that key objective of the improved water security for Wilcannia, but absolutely future-proofs if the rules we are in change in the future.
That was the project manager for the Wilcannia Weir Replacement Project, Sarah Horn, speaking to Oliver Brown.
This is ABC Radio Adelaide, South Australia and Broken Hill.
With Selena Green today. Well, an Australian professor says the spread of avian influenza into dairy cattle in the United States should be monitored closely. The United States Department of Ag says what is commonly called bird flu has been found in 4 dairy herds, but the risk to humans is low, as milk will be destroyed and sick cattle will not end up in the meat supply chain. Professor Marcel Klassen is from Deakin Uni. He studies bird migration and the spread of disease. He says it's a development that does need to be watched closely.
A lot of mammals get infected with avian influenza, and that's weird because avian influenza, as the name already implies, that is a virus that infects birds predominantly, but also mammals can get it. Now, for this virus to transmit amongst mammals, it needs to change, it needs to mutate, it needs to evolve further. But it is worrying that more and more mammals are getting infected, and it's all because of this avian influenza virus becoming so widespread. So although the chance of mammals to become infected is small, just because there are so many of these viruses around, more and more different mammal species become infected. And of course, with that, also the chance of that virus to further evolve and mutate and become more and more adapted to infect mammals, and also for mammals to infect one another with this, then it's not a bird flu anymore, then it is a mammal flu, obviously. But in origin, it was a bird flu. With this virus becoming more and more widespread, the chances of it also becoming more prevalent in mammals only increases.
Is it particularly interesting that dairy cattle have been found with avian influenza in this case?
Yeah, I think so, because so far most mammal species that got infected, they were predators or scavengers, so they nibble on carcasses that they find and eat it, or they kill animals that are moribund and then ingest this virus, and that's obviously an easy way of attracting a viral infection. So but dairy cats, how do they get it? Well, I'm thinking maybe the drinking water. So on the premises where these cows were found to be infected, indeed, they also found wild birds, dead wild birds. So you can imagine a carcass ending up in drinking water, and then that way the cows becoming infected. That's my best guess at the moment, how those cows could get infected.
This is where I get slightly nervous, but I feel it's an important next question to ask. If bird flu can find its way into dairy cattle, is that another step in the chain into finding its way into humans at a greater scale?
Well, the USDA claims not, because, well, they obviously test the milk and they have stepped up the biosecurity, so they test the milk and make sure that milk that is infected, that they take it out of the route to the consumers and destroy it. And then the other thing is the viral load. So it's not that you become infected by just one single virus. Yeah, in principle, that will be possible, but it is, you need to get a fair number of viruses in your system before you truly get infected. Yeah, the risk is only increasing. And that is not just because of dairy cows, but it's just because of this virus becoming so prevalent, because it's really infecting a lot of poultry. So far globally, of this particular strain, 500 million chooks have succumbed, but also millions of wild birds have died because of it. It's just becoming more and more prevalent. And therewith, yeah, it's a numbers game. The chances of such a virus affecting a mammal and also infecting humans is small. But if it is so prevalent, yeah, the chances only increase.
Now that bird flu has found its way into dairy cattle, so pretty big livestock industry as well, away from poultry. Should other areas of livestock be concerned what outbreaks like this could mean for animal health?
Yeah, absolutely. We have to consider that these viruses, notably if they are so prevalent, so I again come to back to it's a numbers game, so that everything can get infected. We saw the same, by the way, in COVID, right? So COVID spread to lots of different animals. So there it started with us, but we are 8 billion people on this globe, so that's a major source. So, but COVID was then found in all kinds of animals. So over the past 25 years, about 1,000 people on this globe that we know of have succumbed of avian influenza. So they got infected with a strain of high pathogenic avian influenza and died because of that. So becoming infected, again, is really difficult. This virus needs to go to a number of mutations to make it really fit for mammals and humans. I cannot stress that enough. So I don't want to cause any panic. It's just that the only thing I want to make a call for that we need to do something about this, because ultimately this is only going to get worse.
As Professor in Ecology at Deakin University, Marcel Klaassen, he specialises in bird migration and diseases ecological issues. He was speaking there to Warwick Long. 10 minutes to 1. Well, finally today, more than 35,000 Pacific Island workers employed across Australia, many of them on farms. Keeping these men and women socially engaged can be really important for their well-being and productivity. Playing sport is often a big part of this. So this week, the Renmark Olympic soccer team donated some old kids to some local workers to take back home to younger players in Vanuatu. Renmark Olympic Soccer Club committee member Hugh Shootmaker explained to Timu King what the exchange was about.
Oh yeah, well, we're welcoming down a few representatives of the Riverland kind of Pacific Island community, and they're going to accept a donation of the club's former kits that we are no longer going to be using. We've got some new kits coming in, some special new kits coming in for the new season, but obviously means that we've got a bit of a surplus here. So the club's got a bit of a connection with the Pacific Islanders going back a few years, of course. So yeah, it's just great to be able to put these towards a good purpose. They'll take them back over to the islands and Vanuatu specifically, and hopefully donate them to younger players and players there that can be used, so they can put them towards a good cause and use them for their leagues and clubs there.
How does it make you feel to see the perhaps things that might have been thrown out or just stored, put in storage, given a bit of a new lease on life?
It's great, and specifically when it comes to like sporting uniforms and stuff, like whether it's like a national sport soccer kit or a club kit, they all carry symbolism and value, and they all represent their local communities. And so yeah, it's great that they will be able to be enjoyed and utilized by a community that's less fortunate and maybe not that far into their development of the support of the sport. And yeah, and we'll be able to know that they're going to a good cause.
Is this the first time this has happened? And if so, is it something you guys are looking to keep on doing throughout the years, every time you do a refresh of the uniform?
Yeah, it is. I think, the first time that they've been donated overseas like this. Yeah. So first time that we have sent them internationally. And yeah, every few years as you turn over sponsors, you do require new kits. So yeah, it'd be something that we'd be more than happy to do. As we said, we've got a strong connection with the communities over there and we love to help them out. And we, yeah, always welcome our relationship with them to grow.
Hugh Shootmaker, Renmark Olympic Soccer Club committee member. Takini Tavui, the chief executive of the Pacific Island Council of South Australia, says the exchange shows the important relationship between communities, sporting teams, and Pacific Island workers.
I think this is, this event today really signifies the importance of relationship, the importance of respect and recognition. We're here today as Olympic, Renmark Olympics, because of a relationship that they had built a number of years in relation to the Vanuatu palm workers, and how they have been able to and embrace them in their community, but also given them the opportunity to play and be part of this community. So this is an opportunity for the club to give back to Vanuatu, who've provided a lot of these workers, a number of these workers, and this would go a long way in those small communities where they come from.
How big is the involvement of Pacific Island workers in local sport itself?
Well, you know, there have been some amazing stories. For example, even in Adelaide locally, rugby league. So when you look at the Pacific, different islands that play, you know, different sport. So if you look at Timor-Leste, Solomon, Vanuatu, they are more soccer. Papua New Guinea is more rugby league. Fiji, Tonga, Samoa, more rugby union. So recently, last year, in South Australia, there was a group of Papua New Guineans at work at an abattoir in Port Wakefield. They obviously play rugby league, and they played in one of those one-day tournaments, and the local rugby league body saw them and said, you know, you guys can actually play in our weekly comp. So they created a club just out of these players who went all the way to the grand final. You know, first, you know, let's come together to work, and that's just an example. Soccer is there, rugby league, rugby union. Barossa Valley is a team, local rugby union team. Last year made it to the semi-final. They've never been there for a long time. So the workers from the Pacific are playing a very critical role in keeping the sport alive, but also engaging the community through their skills in sport.
Have there been any barriers to them participating in local sport that you guys have worked to overcome?
Well, one of the challenges, because, for example, distance travel. So the good thing about Renmark Olympics, this is where the workers are. But you'll have situations where, for example, in Adelaide, it's predominantly rugby. So we've got workers all the way to Narracourt, driving on a Saturday morning, 4 hours, to Adelaide to play rugby. And then Saturday, you know, Sunday, they stay overnight and they drive back. So, and it's wonderful they're committed, but there's, you know, we don't want them driving for that long. It's risky as well. So those are some of the challenges, just transport. And also being able to, you know, have the time to do some training, which is, you know, difficult when you're working full time.
Could there be anything done to remediate those and make it a bit more accessible?
We're doing a couple of things. We're talking with the clubs and we're talking with the employers. The social element of PALM is crucial because this allows workers to enjoy themselves. When they enjoy themselves, it shows in their productivity. So we recognise that, the employer recognises that, and so we wanted to obviously support the employers. Obviously, they've got their objectives, but how can we work with them in the clubs that these workers can be able to mitigate some of those challenges? So that's where we're at the moment. I think, you know, PALM is a big program. It's making a big contribution economically to the nation. But this is a component of PALM that we are seeing a lot of engagement in, which is the social element. You know, the church is a big one, and sport. These are two elements where the workers from the Pacific are actually contributing, because this is part of their lives. It's nothing new to them. And so it is also helping in the integration, them being able to communicate, to connect with the community and be part of the community. So we're really grateful when there's an opportunity like this today, where this can be, you know, the clubs can actually give back to where these workers have come from.
Takini Tavui is the Chief Executive of the Pacific Island Council of South Australia. They're speaking with Timu King. It is 1:03. Well, the sad news is there won't be a country hour tomorrow for Good Friday. The good news is I will be back on Monday with a full Country Hour program for you from noon and from 12:30 for our metropolitan listeners. And more good news, because Nikolai Bailhart's be with you this afternoon. Hello.
Good afternoon. How's it going?
Oh, good.
Good, good. We're going to follow something today that you've been discussing, and this is to do with that idea of, well, do we need kind of mining-style villages to house heaps of employees? This kind of comes off something that came up and Thomas Foods have been talking about. So I just thought it might be interesting to look at, is there still a role for that idea of the company town almost? Because there have been some really prominent examples of that in South Australia in the past. So is that still something that could play a role, or are they those days kind of come and gone, if you know what I mean?
Yeah.
Yeah. So we're going to be taking a look at that. And we've got a couple of big names that will be joining us this afternoon as well. On a Thursday, we try and find out a bit more about some of the names and faces that you see about the place. And Keith Conlon, otherwise known as Mr. South Australia.
What a great name, Mr. South Australia.
It's not a bad title. Of all the titles that people could give you, that'd be the top one.
There's definitely worse ones.
So Mr. South Australia will be joining us But we'll find out a little bit more about him, obviously a huge role in the media, but also to do with history here in South Australia. Again, one of the people that would probably know, be in the very upper echelon of knowing so much about our history here. And Missy Higgins will be with us as well.
I love Missy Higgins.
Yeah.
Please tell her I said hello. She doesn't know who I am, but I'm a fan.
I'll pass on your best. It has been, believe it or not, 20 years since The Sound of White came out and Scar, you know, the massive hit. So she's just been announced that she'll be coming to Adelaide as part of the Cabaret Festival performing that album. So we're going to look back on that a little bit as well this afternoon.
How wonderful. She's one of my favourite live performers. I think I've seen her about three times now, and she's just wonderful. So
excellent.
Lucky you. Mm. Nicola, have a wonderful Easter.
Thank you. You too.
Nicola Balhart's going to be with you this afternoon. He's got some great guests lined up for you. As I said, that's it for me. I'll catch you on Monday, another Country Hour, and keep across the ABC Listen app where you can catch much more.
Lend us your ears. Download the ABC Listen app and find all our audio in one handy place. Tap on the ABC Radio icon and go to our station page.
Discover more great ABC podcasts, live radio and exclusives on the ABC Listen app.